Here we go. All right, so as I was saying, we're going back. The priority population are the University of Alabama students. So, and through research, I found that there are four main factors affecting college students' quality of life. The first one being satisfaction with school, that's namely academic performance. There's also general well-being, social belonging, and having a sense of feeling in control of one's life. So, school-related matters unquestionably dominate a large percentage of time for students. And furthermore, I found an article published by Dr. Houston in 71, and I quote, "The general academic area of students' lives is perceived to be fraught with the most problems." So, as a result, academic performance is our focal quality of life factor. So moving into phase two, the epidemiological, behavioral, and environmental assessment, the purpose of this phase is to pinpoint the targeted health problem that contributes to or interacts with the quality of life factor identified in phase one. So this is essentially divided into two components, the health problem itself and the determinants of health. Depression and anxiety disorders rank fifth in the top five obstacles to college students' academic performance. So, major depression is one of the most common mental health issues that adolescents encounter, and it increases the risk for academic failure. Depressive symptoms include feeling sad, hopeless, anxious, depressed, worthless, fatigued, irritable, having a loss or interest in activities, weight loss or gain, sleep difficulties, and diminished cognitive abilities. Anxiety is characterized by unrealistic or excessive worry about two or more life circumstances. Now, depression and anxiety symptoms are intrinsically interlinked, as typically anxiety or generalized anxiety disorder follows a depressive episode. However, we are sort of, focusing on depression in this particular paper. So, looking at the American College Health Association's National College Health Assessment data, we find that the depressive symptoms experienced by college students in the past 12 months, 45.9% of college students experienced hopelessness, 47.1% experienced overpowering anxiety, 80% experienced fatigue unrelated to physical exertion. 60.2% experienced extreme sadness, and 29.6% of students felt so depressed at some point in the past 12 months that it actually impaired their ability to function. So that's almost one in three. That's quite a statistic. So at this point, we're looking at depression and anxiety disorders, and we want to sort of set our overarching health goal, and that's to improve the mental health status of the University of Alabama students. Relating to that, the health objective is to reduce the prevalence of depression and anxiety disorders, including depressive symptoms, among the University of Alabama students by approximately 20% by 2015. So now we're going to move into the determinants of health. These include genetic determinants, behavioral determinants, and environmental determinants. Genetic determinants are those factors that include a person's genetic makeup as well as intrapersonal factors. So for depression and anxiety disorders, that's a family history of mood disorders, low self-esteem, and introspective rumination. Behavioral determinants for depression and anxiety disorders include tobacco use, frequent binge drinking, as well as binge eating. And those behavioral determinants include actions that put an individual at risk for the target health problem. Environmental determinants are the factors that include the physical surroundings as well as interpersonal factors. For depression and anxiety disorders, these include stress generated by the modern lifestyle, a lack of social support, as well as low socioeconomic status. So at this point, we want to put all of the factors into a prioritization matrix based on importance and changeability. Now, a factor is considered important if it's both present and prevalent within the priority population. It's considered changeable if there's documented proof of changeability, if there's an established time frame required to change the behavior, or if there's an existence of both public and political support for the environmental change. It's important to note that compulsive and addictive behaviors, as well as those deeply rooted in the individual's lifestyle, are not considered easily changeable. So, our target is the more important and more changeable box there. However, there are no determinants that sort of meet those descriptors. So we're looking at the more important and less changeable factors. Regarding low socioeconomic status, earning more lucrative salaries depends on a number of factors both within and outside of the individual's and society's control. So that would be a little tough to target for intervention. The stress generated by a modern lifestyle, there are an inexhaustible number of circumstances that can cause an individual stress. And furthermore, each individual is going to react to and cope with similar stressors differently. So again, we opted not to target that particular factor. So that leaves us with both binge eating and tobacco smoking. 13.8% of college students have used tobacco within the past 30 days. Again, that's from the American College Health Association's NCHA data set. Furthermore, social norms are changing now that tobacco use is really no longer fashionable. And there are a number of mass media campaigns, probably most notably the Truth campaign, that tout the health hazards of tobacco use and exposure to secondhand smoke. And I would actually argue in regards to binge eating that our society promotes overeating with both our general belief in America that bigger is better, as well as the fact that people really eat out as a general rule nowadays versus, you know, an occasional indulgence. So, and when we eat out, restaurant proportions are very large. So, again, that's encouraging overeating. As a result, tobacco use among the University of Alabama students is our target for intervention. So, and we want to set our behavioral objective at this point, and that's to reduce the percentage of the University of Alabama students regularly using tobacco from 13.8% to 9.2% by 2014. I do want to point out that I'm using the ACHA's NCHA data set because there is not a similar data set available specifically for the University of Alabama. Moving into phase three, our educational and ecological assessment. The purpose of this phase is to examine and prioritize factors that could affect the targeted behavioral and environmental determinant identified in phase two. So these factors include predisposing, enabling, and reinforcing factors. Predisposing factors encompass a person's knowledge, attitudes, beliefs, values, and perceptions. So for tobacco use, these factors include self-efficacy, frequent alcohol and marijuana use, as well as a person's ethnicity. The enabling factors include both the interpersonal and environmental barriers that occur before the behavioral or environmental change. For tobacco use, that's the presence of a friend or a family member who smokes or uses smokeless tobacco, a low socioeconomic status, social cues, as well as the existence of rigid tobacco laws. Reinforcing factors include the different types of feedback and rewards that an individual receives after the behavior changes, either going to encourage or discourage the continuation of that behavior. Of note, this can include anticipated reinforcement. For tobacco use, nicotine dependence, and self-medication are those reinforcing factors. Again, we want to put those into a prioritization matrix. This time we have two factors to examine in the more important and more changeable category, self-efficacy and rigid tobacco laws. Now, self-efficacy is a critical predictor of success for those who want to quit smoking. However, we want to target both those who are ready to quit smoking as well as those who might be in the pre-contemplation stage of the trans-theoretical model, meaning that they're not ready to change, they're not ready to stop smoking. As a result, a strong motivating factor would be an environment both on and off campus conducive to a smoke-free lifestyle. So, rigid tobacco laws are a target for intervention. At this point, we want to set our resource objective, and that's to enact 100% tobacco-free laws in the city of Tuscaloosa by 2012. All right, moving into phase four, the fun stuff, the intervention alignment. So the purpose of this phase is to match appropriate strategies and interventions with projected changes and outcomes identified in earlier phases. Just to refresh your memory, our intervention target again is implementing 100% tobacco-free laws throughout the city of Tuscaloosa. This is a community intervention that involves the legislative process, therefore it is a policy intervention. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, one of the most highly effective policy interventions for tobacco prevention and control efforts includes the creation of smoke-free environments. So we're going to be transitioning from tobacco-free laws into smoke-free environment. All right. Tuscaloosa does have a current municipal code on the books that prohibits smoking in theaters or movie houses, public buses, passenger carriers, municipal agencies, municipal agency facilities, and restaurants from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. But as you can see, there's a lot lacking. There's a lot of holes in this particular smoke-free environment code. So our intervention goal is to amend Tuscaloosa's current municipal code to create a 24-hour, 100% smoke-free environment by 2012. So our first step, and I do want to note that the creation of this intervention was based primarily on the Sierra Club's toolkit for passing a local ordinance. And I have attended several advocacy workshops here at the APHA conference that support similar interventions. So the first step is creating a coalition for a smoke-free Tuscaloosa. This is going to unite your community members as well as your business owners. Of note here, there are two people that I would definitely want to include in this coalition. First, Chad Smith. He's the owner and operator of the Alcove International Tavern, which is Tuscaloosa's only voluntary smoke-free bar. And usually with smoke-free policies, some of your strongest opponents to the law are going to be bar owners and operators because of the notion that drinking and smoking go hand in hand, therefore they're going to lose business. That's their perception. The second person, Bob Lundell, he's a city councilman, one of eight in Tuscaloosa, and he was actually the instigator of the current municipal code, and he would love to see a comprehensive 24-hour smoke-free Tuscaloosa. So step two, the coalition will draft a plan of action to pass a 24-hour, 100% smoke-free municipal code amendment. First of all, you've got to employ legal expertise at this point in the process. It's important to have the wording down, all the legal jargon. You want to identify your community foes and friends on the issue. You need to create a fundraising strategy. It's important to draw up a task list. You'll want to outline any and all tasks necessary to pass this ordinance. So that might include the creation of a website, an email listserv, Facebook page, a Twitter account, all those social networking things that are very popular nowadays. You also want to develop committees to manage these specific tasks, such as a volunteer coordination committee, media relations committee, a fundraising committee, et cetera. And at the end of this particular step, you're going to want to submit the final version of this amendment to the mayor of Tuscaloosa for his consideration. And I did speak with the city attorney. What would happen once the mayor got that particular ordinance, he would pass that to the Public Safety Committee for their consideration. And the Public Safety Committee would hold a few months worth of public hearings because this is a controversial issue. So moving into step three, the coalition is going to engage in community outreach at this point, delivering presentations to local organizations that are potential allies. That would be also a great point for volunteer recruitment. Distributing educational materials about the issue to community members. For example, you can create a fact sheet on the hazards of secondhand smoke. Broadcasting information about the issue through local media sources. These are essentially your PSAs. Hosting a petition drive, a letter writing campaign to the city council, as well as attending all Tuscaloosa Public Safety Committee meetings and encouraging allies and volunteers to also attend and speak out in support of this ordinance. In phase four, the Tuscaloosa Public Safety Committee will vote on the amendment after those several months of public hearings. If it passes, it's going to go to the Tuscaloosa City Council to host a final vote on the issue. If it's voted down at that point, the coalition will have to decide whether or not to continue their efforts. Assuming it passes, we move on to step five, where the Tuscaloosa City Council votes on the amendment. If it passes, the intervention is successful. If it's voted down again, the coalition would have to re-examine its efforts and decide whether or not to continue or to end the intervention. So measuring progress is always an important step in any intervention. Therefore, you need to set process objectives to make certain that the intervention remains on task and within its designated time frame. So I've set three. The first objective is by February of 2012, the coalition will submit a 24-hour, 100% smoke-free environment municipal code to the mayor of Tuscaloosa. The second objective is by April 30th of 2012, volunteers will distribute 10,000 fact sheets regarding the health hazards of secondhand smoke and tobacco use to Tuscaloosa citizens. And lastly, during the spring of 2012, the coalition will recruit at least 30 volunteers to voice their support for the smoke-free amendment at each public hearing. You might be wondering why this is all happening in the spring. I don't know if any of you are familiar with football in Alabama, but it is a religion down there. I've been there for 10 months, and this season has been my first experience with it. So it would be very hard to have our voice heard if you're trying to compete with the football season. So, in conclusion, amending this municipal code to create a 24-hour, 100% smoke-free environment in the city of Tuscaloosa is going to decrease the prevalence of regular tobacco use among the University of Alabama college students. So this, in turn, is going to translate to decreased prevalence of depression and anxiety disorders. This, in turn, will improve the mental health status and raise the students' academic performance and general well-being, and the University of Alabama students' quality of life will be improved. So, thank you so much for, a comprehensive list of my references, and thank you so much for listening and sticking with us, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you have. I know I've,
yeah. I've never heard of a place that has, like, you can't smoke from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., but in the same establishment, later.
Yes, and in fact, I will go out for trivia nights with friends. I'm very sensitive to secondhand smoke, and at 10 o'clock, people start lighting up, and I've got to leave. So, because even three or four smokers will end up, I mean, it permeates the entire atmosphere in that bar.
Is there any data to suggest that residual smoke is still there at 7, 8, 9 in the morning during times when smoking's not allowed? And I was just wondering, I'm not sure.
That is a fantastic question. That's sort of beyond the scope of my research. I don't actually know the answer to that question. I didn't look at the data sets for secondhand smoke. But that is a really great question.
I think it might give more oomph. You know, they might say, well, we've already got this time frame. Well, the lingering of that smoke in the environment is an environmental health hazard as well.
Oh, most definitely. And if we put this intervention into play, and it's something I'm actually considering doing over the next couple of years, depending on how things are going with my studies, I would examine every possible angle of the hazards of secondhand smoke, and you've got to have all of your I's dotted and your T's crossed in that particular thing. So I do want to point out that you were surprised. You said that there was like a time limitation. Did you know in Alabama we are not, of course, a smoke-free state? We have 75% of places in Alabama, cities and towns, have a smoke-free policy in place, but only 10% of those are comprehensive. So most of them are very fragmented, just like Tuscaloosa's. Yeah?
I'm just wondering, have policy makers and all this stuff, yes, we can all make policies and all, but how are you going to implement it at this graduate or this school level, basically, or the university level? Because students, whenever you set laws for them, they
well, and are you specifically referring to sort of the policy being on campus?
Well, yeah, or it's going to help improve the students' health and all that stuff. But
yeah. Well, that's why I was actually targeting the city of Tuscaloosa and the entire city, not specifically the campus, but the campus is actually the center of the city of Tuscaloosa. There's probably like a 5-mile radius around the center of campus. So, you're specifically speaking to enforcement issues, correct?
Yeah.
And there have been, actually, with any sort of smoke-free policy, including some of the statewide smoke-free policies, there are always the enforcement issues post-policy approval. And from what I understand, I went to a session yesterday that addressed challenges of enforcement once they passed the Colorado statewide smoking ban. And essentially, what I gathered from that is it's important to really partner with several different agencies for enforcement. Like in this case, on campus specifically, it would be important a strategic health team that specifically one that targets tobacco. So they would sort of be maybe the equivalent of the public health department on campus, if you will. It would be necessary for that team to partner up with the campus police. And then any sort of violations to policy could be reported either to the police or, you know, to that strategic health team. Or might be something where the police pass along those particular concerns to the strategic health team, and then it would be the strategic health team's responsibility to go out and investigate those particular claims. But yeah, you are correct. There's certainly going to be enforcement issues. And I know we've actually, Dr. Nicholson has been a part of trying to create a smoke-free campus, not necessarily the city of Tuscaloosa, but just a smoke-free campus. And they were the team was essentially told by administration that that is not a possibility because we don't know how we would actually enforce that policy. So that's a great, yeah. That's a great question.
Well, I'm from the South, and I'm from California. Mm-hmm. Our city is enforcing all of the other areas to be smoke-free. Mm-hmm. And then certain Starbucks would enforce the smoke-free law, but then other Starbucks would just let the kids smoke. They could take care of them. So
does anybody report them?
There is a sign saying, this premises is smoke-free. Mm-hmm. But then I would see kids smoking, you know, around them, with the Starbucks anyway. So it's really difficult.
Interesting. I did want to address another thing. You had mentioned specifically like the enforcement of that policy and how that's going to translate actually into people quitting smoking, right? I did find a study from Lafayette County that's Lexington, Kentucky, essentially, is also a college town. It's very similar demographics to Tuscaloosa. And the study asserted that they had a smoke-free policy for Lafayette County introduced in 2005 is when that legislation was passed. This study was conducted 24 months following that policy intervention. There had been no additional tobacco cessation programs, no additional tobacco counseling, anything of that nature. The only thing that had changed was the policy. And 16,500 adults, that was one-third of the adult smoking population, had stopped smoking. So there is... I know that there are some enforcement issues, but this could certainly help. Yeah.
Just to comment off that, in New York State, when they implemented their smoke-free policy, it also dropped social smoking dramatically. And it's more, I think a lot of it was weather-related. I mean, who wanted to go outside in the snow
and smoke?
So it was really the people who really wanted to do it would go, and it, I know it reduced social smoking. So that's another thing. I don't know, I guess your weather's a little bit more temperate.
Down in Alabama, it's a little warmer. And I have to say, one thing that concerns me, I know smokeless tobacco rates are surprisingly high in Alabama. That was new to me when I moved down there last year. And I think it would be interesting to also do something with smokeless tobacco because that's still, you know, ingesting of nicotine and chemicals. And so, interesting to see that. Any other questions, comments? Well, thank you all so much for sticking with us. Appreciate it.